liability of a crime. So if there's no way they can be taken back to the grand jury, cleaned up, but if you want him to be able to raise that demur now, so he won't be sitting in the hospital for 10 years, when in fact he hasn't even committed it to a crime, because what's alleged essentially isn't a crime. Or if it's a double jeopardy situation, he shouldn't be held in the hospital under this indictment.
Boy, the statute's run, you can go out of this.
Or if the statute's run, then he should be able to raise that so he wouldn't be held in the state hospital because he's unfit to proceed. That's really what we're talking about. I mean, as far as the motion on behalf of the defendant to inspect things and stuff, but whether or not you have this wouldn't prevent the defense attorney from filing that type of motion.
Although, even under that statute, the defendant could be required to testify if there's a question about whether the object was taken from the possession of the law. Well, these are things that the testimony of the judge is for.
Well, this would be a good place for the discretion of the judges to tell us what the law means, of course. As Jim pointed out earlier, that's, I suppose, what I was getting at, to set out three or four things that we mean, and with our comment as to what the intent and purpose of the provision is, and then allow the court some flexibility by sticking that included but not limited to phrase in there, as insurance against another good point like double jeopardy or statute of limitations, which might occur later.
Maybe the way to do it is leave the language the way it is, and then in the commentary put examples of this sort of the sort of hearing that would be permitted by this section R, A, B, C, and D.
Well, that's what I did, but evidently this didn't appeal to the commission.
Yeah, if they had a problem with this, which is susceptible to fair determination,
I didn't like that phrase, even with the explanation.
I'm going to put these four things
I suppose if the court construes it specifically or in very narrowly to include only these four, that at least the defendant is farther along than he was before. It's some advance in what otherwise might be a very unjust situation.
Of course, just to
let me ask you,
how was double jeopardy raised? Is that raised by a demur?
Please. Presently is raised by a plea.
That's a separate plea. Now, the statute of limitations can be raised by a demur.
Yeah.
And so can whether or not it states a good cause of action.
So that actually the at least the sufficiency of the indictment, the statute of limitations is run. What's the other one?
Venue is improper. I don't know whether that one fits or not, but it struck me as being the kind of situation that might be covered.
At least these two things could be raised by demur, and they could be done even without this statute. Because the demur is filed by...
Well, I'm not sure anybody today would listen to the demur.
Yeah, I've got it right here.
Yeah, I don't... Of course, I don't know, but I'm under the impression that the defendant can do nothing after he's been declared incompetent.
Certainly, that's my impression, is that once he's down there, why, you just come to a screeching halt.
And that's why this thing is here, and the policy seems to be meet the approval. I don't think I heard anybody object to the policy behind it.
Let me ask you this. Suppose that... Let's say, take one about which is known. Suppose you find an indictment on which the statute of limitations is run, and the defendant is down in Salem, down at the state hospital, and his lawyer goes in and demurs on the statute of limitations. The court says, you're absolutely right, the indictment's thrown out. What happens to him?
He'd have to be civilly committed.
So that's a good question.
Well, do we provide for that?
once he's down there, we haven't thought that far ahead. I hadn't.
What do we do with it at that juncture? Suppose he, suppose the court is nutty enough to grant the motion.
He's down there on the basis of the authority of the court acting in this case.
Yeah, but all of a sudden the indictment has disappeared.
He comes back. It's great.
Because he's down there on the basis of his competency to proceed.
Yeah, I guess we ought to put another stitch in this, shouldn't we?
So it's already proceeding.
I think he's automatically released.
Well, it becomes moot, doesn't it? Because you don't have any proceedings
that's right.
to go on.
Right.
You can't get through a lot of indictment once the indictment's gone.
I think we ought to say it.
Of course, the statute of limitations.
As part of this section, the defendant is successful in the.
You could get into the situation where the defendant's testimony might be required. Which would be like, you know, if he's been out of the state or in hiding, it tolls the statute.
Well, he couldn't. If he asked participate personally, he wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see any need to put a provision in it.
I would think so, but gosh, you wonder.
Yeah,
of course
no
not. I think
for
it's all right.
His competency is gone.
And the judge is the one that determined his incompetency, and I would think certainly retains the power to declare the release. Wouldn't you, Judge? Did you have any qualms about that? Nobody put him down there but you. You put him there. You certainly
yeah,
can
say. He's probably guilty of something. We want to do something to him.
Suspicions.
I got habeas corpus to get him out then.
Well.
Probably a bad guy.
Well, when you throw out the. If you sustain a demur, when you throw that out, then you just hold him to answer to the grand jury on the resubmission by the state.
Of course, you know. One of the things also is that if we write this in and then we come up with different procedural attacks on indictments and so on, we might find ourselves. I don't think the venue is improper really on reflection. I'm not sure that ought to be in the case because really the only time you raise venue.
During the trial.
Yeah. Well, in theory, you can raise it. Suppose that.
Well, if the body's found in Lane and the charge is brought in Benton, you can raise
you wouldn't
it
until the time of trial.
Yeah.
Because the indictment, unless the indictment said that in the county of Lane he did this, and here you are right there.
Well, in which event you can demur to
it. Certain court.
In which event you can demur to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see.
The only time you'd, suppose the indictment read, defendant killed the victim on the 28th day of May in Oregon, period. Now, you'd be attacking venue in one sense of the word, but what you do is demur, because it clearly is an insufficient indictment. It doesn't confer jurisdiction on the Benton County Circuit Court or any other circuit court. So I wouldn't, that as an example I would take out.
Well, I wasn't too sure about it.
I must say I don't know how a double jeopardy thing could come up on the motion stage. Presently doesn't.
I've never had double jeopardy raised, so
It did come up one time in the Garrett case in Portland, and that was a real screwball kind of a situation where the girl set her house afire and killed two or three children, and they tried her once for felony murder, and she was acquitted. So then they indicted her on the second kid, and the defense came in and set this up by way of a so-called plea of double jeopardy, and let me see what happened. So then the state came in and demurred to the plea of double jeopardy. Already denied the demur, and then they they said, "Well, we're all through. We're ready to go to trial." And they said, "No, you got to file an answer or reply or some darn thing, because at this juncture that's a good plea of jeopardy, given the peculiar facts of this case." So ultimately, that's the way the case was disposed of.
Yeah. Well, and then the state tried to appeal that.
They
said that wasn't a ground for state appeal.
And they dismissed the appeal because the state couldn't appeal in those cases.
And that case led to an amendment of the statute relating to state's appeal, too, as I recall.
You now appealed it.
Well, no, but this was, the state was trying to appeal an order allowing the double jeopardy plea, I think.
But in any event,
it didn't fit into the
upshot was double jeopardy was brought to the attention of the court in the second indictment, not with a factual hearing of any kind.
Yeah. Well,
that's the only time I can think of where it could get anywhere near. Because normally you'd say, well, we've got a plea of double jeopardy, and so you try it out at the time of trial.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the specific...
What you do is oftentimes is you agree to try that aspect to the court before you start in the trial of the main case.
Well, it could certainly be disposed of before the main case, clearly, just on the record of the other trial.
But it would normally require some evidence.
The defendant doesn't have to participate.
Not guilty.
Counsel can go ahead and put on whatever evidence he could muster.
The crime charge, which may be pleaded either with or without a plea. That's how you raise double jeopardy.
How's that done in here?
It's the third type of plea provided by statute. You have guilty, not guilty, or a former judgment of conviction or acquittal of the crime charge, which may be pleaded either with or without a plea of not guilty. Presentation of the plea and sets out the form. The defendant pleads that he has already been convicted or acquitted of the crime charged in this indictment by judgment of the court of blank, blank, blank. Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why the language of the Model Penal Code reads the way it does. To avoid the specificity.
Now you see, 138060, appeal by the state, was amended in 1963, and it was a result of that Garrett case, because the state may take an appeal from a judgment for the defendant on a demur to the indictment to an order sustaining a plea of former conviction or acquittal, which is what the order was that the state was trying to appeal in that case. Because the court held in that Garrett case that it was not provided for by statute. State had no people.
That's not the new one, is it? Down the new paperback?
No.
That's from last year, 2 years.
This is 68.
Yeah.
Criminal code.
I want to remember and ask Bob to put that out again. My students find it very useful. Get another issue. Well,
I already think the only two kinds of things you'd have would be the first two, the insufficiency of the indictment and the statute of limitations.
Well, if that's so, then let's list them. And if somebody in the full commission says, well, no, what about, we can stick that one in. Mm-hmm. And if in later times another one occurs, the legislature can stick it in, I guess. That's kind of the cop-out way to do it, but I kind of hate to see the policy get lost because of the obvious difficulties of drafting.
Well, I'm still concerned about the former jeopardy part of it, though. It is inscrutable without the active participation of the defendant. I think it should be clear. Otherwise, this guy, yeah. It may be a good former jeopardy plea. He's still going to sit down there in the can and work in.
It's really not unfair to the state. That's really, that issue isn't unfair to the state, is it? You're not trying the facts of the case before you at length.
I always thought.
The idea is, let's not be unfair.
I had the wrong idea, maybe, that I always thought that a plea of double jeopardy was determined by the court before you went to trial.
Well, I think in the vast majority of cases where it's involved, it is. I think it essentially involves a legal determination, but it might not.
I mean, it'd be just like the motion to suppress. You'd have an evidentiary hearing, maybe, to determine whether or not you're talking about the same crime or if you're talking about a different crime. But then the court is going to determine as a matter of law whether or not it's double jeopardy.
Well, I think if it can be provable without the active participation of the defendant, it should be allowed.
That's within the purpose of the.
Yeah. That's why we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, maybe the thing to do is just write in those three things and use your included but not limited to language.
We could just make it a court discretionary situation. Any matter of which is discretionary to the court. It'd be fairly determined. Yeah, we're fairly determined without the actual discretion of the court.
Well,
but you got a problem there with kind of waiving things.
Yeah, and you've got a problem with some appellate court coming along and saying, well, this is the kind of thing that historically a jury was needed for, and here you're taking it away from them. I don't know.
Well, the court would still have some discretion to expand the kind of things on the justum generis principle, I suppose.
Put those three matters in and say it's such other matters as the discretion of the court.
But they wouldn't necessarily have been filed. I think the tendency of most lawyers would be not to do anything pending the competency hearing. And customarily comes up, are you ready to enter a plea? No, I'm not. I want to have an examination before we go any further in this matter. No. Because well, that's true. But
yeah, well, they want this competency hearing first because this is usually where the defense counsel gets his first look at.
Immediately at the time of arraignment or immediately thereafter. He says, "Are you ready for plea?" No, I want 10 days because I want to file a demur. That's okay. But customarily, it's at or immediately after arraignment that the examination hearing is had.
Of course, it wouldn't have to be. I mean, good practice would be, I would think, to dispose the other matters first before you just run them out for arraignment.
You mean demurs and so on?
Yeah, I mean, if the defense counsel felt that he had a good demur, you know, so that he couldn't be re-indicted and put away, he probably, rather than filing, you know, asking for a competency hearing, probably would go ahead and file it.
My impression would be that most defense attorneys are so apt apprehensive about getting accused of doing a lousy job, being incompetent, that they just ask for it right away, right at the arraignment stage, before they ever really stew about anything.
Well, I suppose I'd go ahead then, and
why don't you go ahead and
I'll go ahead and draft those three specific things in and throw in included but not limited to.
That would be demur to the indictment, plea of double jeopardy, and
statute
of limitations. Not just anything.
Then maybe why don't you try to use Dave's language about or such other legal objection which is susceptible of fair determination and so forth and so on.
Okay.
Now there's one other provided by statute, motion to set aside the indictment.
On what ground?
Yeah, well, I'm.
Yeah, what about situations
not endorsed, the names of witnesses and that sort of
John L. Jones, not the same John L. Jones.
What did you say?
Let me raise a question to the judge. When they arrest John L. Jones and haul him in and put him in jail.
Happens all the time.
You go in and plead not guilty.
No, then that Johnny L. Jones is going to be a fool. Sent down to the state hospital. What? How do you get him out of the state hospital?
Not a lot.
Well, when the criminal charges are dismissed,
code equity.
He, of course, would be released, and then probably, if he's so incompetent, that.
Both of these drafts today come out of subcommittee number two. And the reporter for both of these was Roger Wallingford, so I'll have Roger go ahead with the discussion on these. That's okay.
Page one, we have the bribery section, we have definitions. We have three definitions. First definition of benefit, and benefit is defined primarily to clarify the definition of number two, pecuniary benefit. As far as this section is concerned, the aspect that the subcommittee spent the most time on is definition of number two, pecuniary benefit. You'll notice on beginning on the second line, that does not include a political campaign contribution reported in accordance with ORS Chapter 260.
Who's on that
subcommittee, Mr.
Chairman?
Wrote on this.
Finally
analyzed
it. The same group. Letters, letters. Yeah. The three, like, overall office holders, you know, wrote that in.
The same group that handled the sex article.
You're never going
to
make
it. No, I told the subcommittee, I thought this was a courageous approach to this subject that they've taken here in this draft.
You do live in Marion County.
I'm going to get one of those. Right. I'll do that.
Well, the problem is.
And the reason for that is, if you, we'll kind of skip ahead, but for example, on page five, where section two, you have bribe giving, where you have a party conferring a pecuniary benefit upon a public servant with the intent to influence his vote, opinion, judgment, action, decision, or exercise of discretion. And it's clear that if campaign contributions were excluded, a literal reading of that would include campaign contributions. In other words, people contribute money to political campaigns quite often with the intent of indirectly influencing the public servant's later decision, assuming he's elected.
What you're saying is that's a good idea.
Well, we're saying
this is treated in another statute.
Right. Well, that's all it requires. It doesn't say it was good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, no, I think disclosure is all we can do. Because you can't tell me that any political contribution is generally made with some intent to try to influence someone's judgment. You take it literally. Well, all right. Associated Oregon Industries, the AFL-CIO, I give a political contribution.
Oh, I agree. And
it isn't because they just believe it. Because
they love you. Well.
Is a drink properly
given to you? You really should. It is lovely, right?
Supposing that I buy a judge or some elected official a drink, and my intent really is to influence his decision in a matter that's going to be notorious.
That'd be a question. When you look at the definition of benefit,
property
means gain or advantage to you, for example, whether you could construe a drink as being a gain or advantage to you.
Well, but pecuniary benefit includes property. Bribe giving is conferring or agreeing to any pecuniary benefit, which is a drink on a public servant, with the intent to influence the public servant's voice, opinion, and so forth. It would be a matter of proof, I suppose, but actually it would come within this definition. Yeah.
Well, I suppose it'd be property. You could literally construe these type of statues, anything, whether it's a drink or a lunch, Christmas card.
Well, actually, wouldn't that same thing be true under the Brown statute?
I think it is. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Let me know the statute. It seems to me
this, if I read the definition of what's coming on, it's happening. This would say, as long as it's made a matter of record, it doesn't make any difference what the purpose. Joe Bananas wants to come out here and finance the Attorney General's campaign when the House Attorney General is handling appeals out there. Take it easy on Joe's boys. That's okay as long as the Attorney General reports that Joe Bananas gave him $100,000.
Let's think about the campaign contribution. Also, bribe is generally it's supposed to be utilized for purposes of running for office, as opposed to what we think of as bribes going into the individual pocket for individual use. Won't be reported probably yet, whereas the campaign contributions have full disclosure.
Here it comes, God.
Yeah. And
sure wasn't yes, there was disclosure.
It wasn't bribery.
Disclosure of the gift, but no disclosure of what he did with it.
Well, but that was
260 requires both.
Yeah, that's right. It requires both. And and the thing is, I think we have to recognize that political contributions, that the real sanction there is the ballot box. I don't think there's any question that there are some political contributions. We all are aware of this, but there are some political contributions where I'm sure it's merely been asked to provide some favor in return, which is totally unproven.
You don't even need to ask for favor. It's the point. All they have to do is be the intent on the part of the giver,
sure.
Donator.
That's
doors don't need door, and it has that effect. It doesn't even need to involve the politician, unless we exempt the politician. It has nothing to do with what his intention is. Or how he acts. If the giver, Bill North, intends that it involves, he's committed to it.
And that is true of the present statute.
Yes, but we're talking here about the political campaign.
Well, I appreciate it, but essentially, if you look at the present statute, it gives a gift or a valuable consideration. With intent to influence the voter decision of the official.
Yeah.
You could just as well say that right now you could prosecute somebody who worked for making campaign.
Did you have somebody guilty of giving a bribe, but at the same time the person not guilty of receiving the bribe because of intent?
That's a gift. That's an intent bribe.
I mean, if I try to bribe you and you don't take it as a bribe, well, then I'm guilty of
But I had no intent.
Oh, I don't believe in intent. It's the crime of bribe giving. If
requires it. No, no evil on the part of the recipient now under this draft. Just if I intend to give to influence your vote, to, you may even be ignorant.
It's equal.
Well, I can read the Webb's item and it's been stopped there.
Well, this seems to be the sanction is the valid thing.
This is not right. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the, we were very concerned about this because the obvious interest of the public when we exclude a political campaign, it has a practical, it looks like we, seven legislators, are carving out our own nest here. And we discussed it a long time, but we felt that the committee, the subcommittee, felt that this was a necessity, and we would leave the pecuniary benefit in the campaign bit. Now, if you get into the Dodd situation where somebody takes it and doesn't report it in the campaign, then you got them right here. Because we didn't absolve the responsibility of reporting the campaign. We said, we'll leave that the campaign contribution as such, and the intent of the donor will go into the 260. And I grant you that that's no crime as long as everybody reports it. But if they don't report it, fall back into this. Because you have to comply with 260 to get out from under the bribery statute. So the Dodd situation would be in point. If Dodd doesn't report it, you're back under this one. And
well, my reason I raised this is because one of the problems of this whole draft, whole business is going to have is people who seize upon one part or another, and it's rather to find understanding. The sex crime thing is a perfect case in point. Asking to cite you a few cases on the thing, you know, and cite you because nobody's ever been tried one. Nobody's ever been charged. So it become useful statutes. But I think somebody who leaps through this thing, if just the member, that any member of the legislature leaps through it, that'll be fine.
Well, of course, when you look at the definitions you have, you need to have a fairly broad definition in order to cover the kind of conduct you really want to get at. But at the same time, recognizing that things such as not campaign contribution, and not only that, but other attempts to influence legislation should not come into the bribery.
Normal lobbying.
Yeah.
So, sure.
Now, the Michigan committee wrestled with the same problem. The only thing was that they took a less direct approach to trying to resolve it. They comment on it in their commentary. They say, well, obviously, things such as log rolling the other attempts to influence legislation, the other legitimate attempts to influence legislation should not be covered. But they recognize that their definitions, their statements of the crime are broad enough that they could be argued to prohibit such things. But they try to make it clear in their commentary that they don't intend to cover that type of thing.
Neither Michigan nor New York makes a specific exclusion, though.
No, but they do. They do explicitly discuss it in their commentary.
Yeah. This is the thing that I suspect that the quick lookers are going to take a quick look at the whole statute. Never going to read the content of it. And I think this is the problem here. And I prefer it, just from that standpoint, if it could be handled. And I realize that the law is the law and the commentary isn't the law. But I'm sure all the judges and attorneys and so forth, the state reads the commentary.
Well,
there
hasn't been any problem in the past.
we didn't have Ainsworth and Portis.
No, it might be an increasing problem. As Jed Byrne pointed out, our present statute could conceivably include campaign contributions, but no prosecutions have ever been brought in this case.
Well, just for the purpose of setting the term, I move to move the last clause sub 2 in substance into the commentary and expand upon it to make sure that it's recognized. Not only refer to things like campaign contributions, but normal lobbying activities, and the right of citizens to appear before their legislatures, and buy them a lunch while they're so doing it, so.
Or not included.
Not included, standing.
Chairman, discussion? I don't know whether I'm ready to vote on the motion, because frankly, I did not, and I'm ashamed to say I'm the only one here probably that can make this condition. I haven't read all the drafts and the minutes of the subcommittee that considered this. However, perhaps Roger or Wally could answer for me why you felt necessary to put a separate definition of pecuniary benefit in. Oh, no, Model Penal Code has it too. They all have it, all the states have a separate.
Benefit by a sophist who bribed.
Yeah, okay.
Fair relations.
Yeah, they all have.
Of course, the main advantage to having your separate definition of benefit is to indicate that the benefit doesn't have to run directly to the recipient, it can run to a third person.
You could actually incorporate those two into one. You'd have a rather long sentence.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand what the basic purpose is. I get the feeling what you're saying is that we ought to remove it to the commentary, essentially because you're afraid it sticks out like a sore thumb and somebody's going to come along and raise hell with it.
And I think in the commentary, expand upon it and point out that we're not just talking about money or a lot of Sun River, commercial interest or economic gain. We're talking about the normal process of lobbying by a company or a trade association or by an individual private citizen or a school board or anybody else. And that we recognize as part of the normal legislative government process. We think it's fine.
I'm not at all sure that if somebody wants to take a swat at us on an out-of-context situation like happened on the second deal, I'm not at all sure they couldn't do it just as well by picking it out of the commentary and saying, look, we're working better in our own nest of the commentary and trying to hide it.
I don't think that they would be inclined to do so if there was a commentary that brought enough to indicate that everybody that didn't confine it to. That's really confined to somebody who's filed in public office. Somebody who's gone through the process and goes on.
I don't see how they could take on us too much, because we do have Chapter 260. Contributions are proper. There's a procedure for reporting them. And certainly, DA can come along and say this is bribery when someone that made contributions and reported them as in a manner permitted by Chapter 260.
You know the district attorney in Marion County?
Well, this is the other consideration. God knows I have a personal interest in it.
We got a section on that, too.
I'll tell you, if you look at the files over my office, I think they're wrong. It's a question of when these acts, which are designed to protect the public from corrupt influences and so forth, are becoming really a tool for political gain. I don't just refer to my own case, I refer to the number of instances where people are using the inspection statute. That is not for any real reason other than just to embarrass people and play games. I think the end result of this, and somebody brings a prosecution against somebody like that, I think we all know what the effect of this charge is. Suppose I bring a suit against Jim Burns, charging him with violation of the statute, regardless of whether he gets off or not. The fact is, it's, the charge has done a lot of damage, and I think it does a lot of damage basically. It's creating a distrust in public officials.
Charge by itself does almost as much damage as a conviction.
in these kind of cases. Well, I think there's considerable merit in Bob Chandler's motion, because it goes beyond the political campaign contribution thing. And really, it expresses that what we're attempting to do here is to point out that these various activities that he has described do not constitute bribery as we contemplated in this article.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on page 2 of the draft, the last paragraph there, the commentary to that section, addressed itself to these other situations, other than campaign contribution. It does not contemplate inclusion of persons advising public officials in a private capacity. A lobbyist, for example, is not a public servant, since in advancing his views, he promotes private interests. A practicing attorney would not normally be a public servant, since he does not exercise the functions of a public officer. Designation as an officer of the court does not create a contractual relationship empowering him to act on behalf of the state. A businessman advising a member of the executive or legislative branch of government in the absence of official status would not be a public servant.
Of course, that doesn't go as far as what the lobbyist mentioned. This says the lobbyist is not a public servant. What he is saying is that a lobbyist approaching a public servant. I don't think
the state probably has more of the kind of activity that I'm talking about than the other state in the country.
No other legislature holds so many hearings on so many stupid bills. No other legislature has so many citizens all over the darn state appearing in public and private capacities to talk to legislators in particular about pending legislation.
And isn't this, as I was made before, we're not saying that this thing is going scot-free. We're saying this is a matter of the Corrupt Practices Act and the election law. It's not criminal.
Corrupt practices. How do we set for a reference in the commentary?
Is there any advantage having the language of the law?
In the commentary, what? A lot of us have a question, what effect does the commentary have? I mean, you can read the statute, and that's what the statute expressly says. It's in the form of money, property, commercial interest, or economic gain.
Well, the reason I look at it, three things we've been following: the Model Penal Code, the Michigan Revised Code, and the New York Revised Penal Law. None of them saw fit to make this specific exemption that we do now.
What else would you cover in your commentary other than recorded political contributions? What other types of activity?
What other types of activity? Well, I think the
normal social drink, the lunch, the ride in the car, the airplane ride to Bend or something of this sort of thing.
Well, actually, if you look at page 3, the Model Penal Code does have such information in their definition of benefits. They just state it differently. Right? They say that this does not include an advantage promised generally to a group or class of voters as a consequence of public measures which a candidate engages. Support or oppose.
Yeah, that's coming the other way.
Yeah, it's generally group or class.
But take the
situation. You put it in your commentary. Does it handle this situation? This is a perfectly ethical situation. It occurs, it often occurs. A group says, what is your position on issue X? You say, my position is this. Okay, that's our position. We're going to contribute to your campaign and support you in every way we can.
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, you can put it in the commentary, but I don't think that...
I'm not trying to change the thrust of what's being attempted.
But shouldn't we really recognize that political contributions is an ethical area that raises problems?
Yeah.
But
and we've got another statute. Actually, I'm not arguing against the idea of making a choice of country. I'm just arguing against the idea of. Somebody looks up here and says, here's seven members of the legislature and a few tame laymen and some others scattered around here came up here and looked at this thing and feathered their own nest. Made sure that none of them were ever going to go to the Moose Jaw and result of this new criminal business.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burns.
Occurs to me that there would be instances where a campaign contribution would be a direct bribe. No question about it whatsoever. Now, if we put a specific exclusion in the definition of the statute, or in the definition, which is applicable to the statute, we would be saying that in no instance would a giving of a campaign contribution constitute a bribe.
As long as you report.
Huh?
As long as you report, then
right.
You go.
Right. That's a departure from the present law, from the present bribery statute. Now, I've got some serious questions with respect to sections 2 and 3, and particularly section 2, we'll get to that later, but the actual bribery statute. But as a matter of policy, is it the wise and judicious thing for us to do, without regard to whether what the people are going to say, that under no circumstance is the giving of a campaign contribution
Let me give you an example.
Constitute a crime?
Is this a matter you want to make a crime out of this? You go out, one of us goes out, we go, I go give a speech to the AFL-CIO. I say, now look, I'm going to support labor. And every time labor has a bill they're interested in, I'm going to vote for it. I'm saying this publicly. And I want your support, I want your work, I want your money. But you know as well as I do, there are speeches that are very close to that, made all the time. Now, is there anything wrong with that?
No, but that precedes. The language of Section 2 says that you commit bribery if you confer the pecuniary benefit with the intent to influence. The act of proposing it to the officer.
Suppose you go home and say, what do I do to get your support?
And they say, you go right down the line with us.
Yeah, or no. We want you to vote on Measure X.
I think, Lee, perhaps you're...
I'm
you're,
glad to support me.
I think you're overlooking the culpability requirements that are written into the section here, but are incorporated by reference through another article, which say that in order for this bribery to be a crime, it has to be accompanied by a degree of culpability. And
culpability is there, James. You know, all the elements.
Well, I confess it's a tough question.
The only thing is it's out in the open. I mean, political contributions, I don't think you can really analyze it. Political contributions are a form of bribery. And I think we ought to frankly recognize
them.
They raise an ethical problem. The reason we allow them is because we have not found, society has not found an alternate means of financing campaigns. And I think the only way, if we're going to allow them, the only way we can deal with them is to require disclosure.
That's about like saying that your power bill is a form of extortion, but that you allow it because you regulate the extortion with the state. You regulate the political bribery by requiring that.
Once you allow political contributions, you raise all these ethical problems.
Well, I don't agree with you completely. I don't think that every political contribution is a form of bribery. A lot of it depends on the amount and the circumstances under which it is made.
And often the opponent.
Well, yes, yeah,
supposing
that
just
by a $5 contribution.
There's hardly a campaign that doesn't have contributions in it, which are made with the hope that the candidate will...
No doubt about it.
There are many situations where a candidate, quite openly, goes out to get somebody, some group support, and makes promises right there on the spot, and everything else, and I don't think really we regard it as wrong.
Dave?
Well, about 3 points on that. First of all, commentary versus putting it in the statute. I have a basic distrust of putting things in commentary, because if there ever is, of course, a differentiation between commentary and law, the law is going to take care of it. Commentary is nothing more than intent. Second of all, as far as campaign contributions, I think they're entirely separate from the actual bribery situation, insofar as the person making the contribution is gambling on someone who's getting an office. Bribery is a person presently in office, presently capable of doing the harm that we're trying to stop. And yes, now, I grant you there are situations where the office holder now has it, he's running again for re-election. But campaign contributions are in the future. Hopefully that opponent will do it. Hopefully the system will put two opponents against each other who may take care of the problem. Thirdly, I think the problem that Bob raised is a very good one. That's the small benefit. And I wonder if we can cure that by, in sub 1 of section 1, of putting a word as substantial. I mean, benefit means substantial being an advantage. And in sub 2, pecuniary benefit means a substantial benefit. Now, we're putting in a situation where we're letting a court say what's substantial. But is the lunch a substantial benefit? Is 5 lunches? Is 100 lunches? We're the same person. Is the plane ride to Bend or to California a substantial benefit? It does put an area of
Not to Bend.
No, I think you have to have a little bit of flexibility in there, because somebody's going to pick this up. And one, you go to an AOI luncheon and have lunch and paid for it. That's a benefit, as I read this thing.
Now, I think you have a good point.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, I think if you want to read the present law strictly.
Read it, of course.
Any person who corruptly gives, offers, or promises to give any gift of gratuity, value, or consideration, or thing, whatever, or who corruptly promises to do or cause to be done any act beneficial to any judicial, legislative, or executive officer, with intent to influence the vote, opinion, decision, judgment, or other official conduct, the officer in any matter, and so forth, which then is or by law may come to be or be brought before the officer, intent to influence him to act in a particular manner, shall be punished, and so forth. I think if you want.
Well, you have vagueness in that, corruptly.
Really, if you want to read an AOI lunch into that, I think you can do it. The fact of it is, by tradition and practice and common sense,
Jim,
and so on.
That isn't necessarily true, because I don't think until last year we had many people basically trying to use these statutes to embarrass public office.
I appreciate that, but the point I'm making is the present statute is subject to this type of abuse if you have a venal prosecutor or whatever.
Well, is it with the word corruptly in there?
That's the modifier.
Uh-huh. He says, I want you to vote such and such a way on issue X.
I'd be recorded as still.
You going to send a designee? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You recorded as no proxies anymore.
Well, we do have a problem. I think that Representative Frost's suggestion may be helpful.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree up to the point of the substantial. We spent a good bit of yesterday working on conflict of interest, which is the one to which I made reference in the legal comment, which is coming out of subcommittee to, well, make another question. That's just before we got into prosecution with gun control, our next two. And we had trouble with substantial, because substantial, and Frank and I were just talking about it, I think a serious question could be raised with constitutionality of making a crime based on the word substantial, because then the jury or the court some months after you committed the act determines whether or not the thing you did was a crime. I really think that the word substantial satisfies us, because then the lunch is gone and the coffee and the coffee shop is gone. But still, the jury, we don't know what substantial is. I mean, you don't know at the time you commit the act whether it's a crime or not, you can't find out. You have to wait until you're brought to trial and hold people to something. And as much as I'd hate to use the word substantial, I think it's a bad new time. How about it'd be a good answer, but I think it's just bad. We ran a conflict of interest. Substantial conflict of interest. What's a substantial? Is it a tiny bit?
Like being substantially,
we talked a good part yesterday afternoon about that. That's
right. No, I mean, I see guys who are defending Fortas on one lane who are going back on something. Perhaps less consequence were just kind of cut into it, but vice versa.
Well, here's the point Lee mentioned yesterday, and in his context, and it's very interesting. Substantial depends not only upon the material thing, the widget that's transacted, but upon the position of the individual. Because take Ainsworth, a $14,000 stock transaction to me would be so substantial that, you know, it would be out of this question. But a $14,000 stock transaction to a man worth nothing, what's that? That's nothing. So you have to induce the element of personal wealth.
And then you got to get the jury to put themselves in the position of having the same reaction as the medical chimp.
So I
you're applying a subjective standard, and that would be, that's bad. We've got to go on the standard, an objective standard. Because I agree that using the word substantial would be unwise. It wouldn't give a party notice.
Well, I know. As far as the lobbying,
what can be given, for example, and what cannot. A lunch or a coffee. Is there an area in between where there's a dividing
line? Is it bigger than a bread box?
It can be eaten in one day, not in one bag, or one home. Eaten in one day, consumed in one night, or worn out in one day.
This shouldn't be.
Well, Paul Rudd said about it all.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Bob,
there's one thing that disturbs me a little bit. Supposing that your motion is defeated, and this remains as it is, will these minutes then be interpreted as saying that lobbying activities and the other things that you have mentioned are within the scope of bribery? So if it is defeated, I think you should make another motion that whether this is in here or not, that the minutes and commentary should reflect that these other things are not intended to be included. Do you agree?
Yes. Yeah, I'm not trying to put people running for office, people in office, or anybody else on the spot.
One thing more. Now, this refers to an ORS chapter 260. What if that chapter is changed?
Then.
Or what if there are other amendments to it, or the law is changed?
Then
should we confine this strictly to that chapter, or should we say, or whatever statutes that are governing that, those things?
Theory. I don't think we can make it broad enough to cover any amendments that might be later made to by the legislature to that, strengthening that chapter. And I suppose this is a job for legislative council.
Don, you don't think that's a problem?
No, I don't, because I think any later changes in the law, routinely they have to amend any other statutes that are cross-referenced by the basic statute.
Supposing that this later through amendment and changes becomes chapter 324.
Then when that basic chapter, the Corrupt Practices Act, if it's changed, then there would be a section in it to amend this section of the criminal code.
To my substantial suggestion that people
Wally Carson says that Frost didn't know what he was talking about, because if we were to insert the word substantial here, the court would undoubtedly declare it to be unconstitutional.
Well, he would manifestly can.
Pardon?
He would manifestly can, because...
Yeah. Well,
Are you ready for the motion?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah?
Could I have unanimous consent to abstain from voting on this? I've got a conflict of interest.
No.
No. Mr. Chairman, could I point out one thing? That
yes.
It seems to me that you don't have to take an either-or approach to this, that the commission seems to me could see fit to retain 7-2 in its present form, and at the same time direct the staff to expand the commentary to discuss this to a greater extent, such as your lobbying situation, your log rolling, and that kind of thing.
That was my
point. Why don't you always have to wait until all this half-hour wrangling is gone before you come up with this suggestion?
Tom?
Roger, all your campaign contributions that have to be reported, which is preliminary to an actual election. We talked about lunches and plane rides. Those things could be bribes, and they're not excluded.
That's
so
right.
Actually, all we're talking about is contributions given to the candidate that's going to file his practice affidavit sometime subsequent to the election. And everything else in subsequent to the election could be a bribe if it's given properly.
All those in favor of Bob Chandler's motion, raise their right hands.
I was afraid this was going
to be. Those opposed, motion is defeated.
Bob, now you feel like I can say.
All of those in favor of having the commentary reflect the content of Chandler's motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
You're batting 500.
What a commentary.
Mr. Chairman, I assume that the revised commentary will again be subject to our inspection and approval.
Well, I would assume so, yeah. We'll have it done.
Certainly.
Oh!
They all are.
Next time we sir.
Now where are we, Roger?
Well, I guess we're now on Section 3 of Section 1. Where we define what is a public servant.
Did you take this definition from any place, Roger? Is it in the civil service statute?
No, it's, if you look on page 3, Model Penal Code 77.
Now they specifically include judges, don't they?
Public servant, I think, is has been changed by the subcommittee originally.
Right.
The original draft on this followed the Model Penal Code, I believe, didn't it? And then this language you have in there now is substantially the same as we have in ORS.
Does this include witnesses?
No, we have a separate statute.
Specifically, it doesn't include witnesses. The other states, I don't remember why.
Does include jurors.
Includes jurors, but excludes witnesses.
Well, you have different problems with witnesses. I mean, in framing the elements of the crime. Where you
have that's covered in another section.
Yeah, so yeah. It's obstruction.
Well, it's going to be incorporated in here.
As a matter of fact, that's what you worked on yesterday.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a question about the definition of 3 sub B. The person serving as an advisor, consultant, or assistant at the request of direction of the state. What, for example, where would you place a committee recently appointed by the Commissioner of Labor, a so-called ad hoc committee, to do something or other? I forget what they're going to do. They're going to look into discrimination of women or something like that. He just swamped up a so-called ad hoc committee. Now, are they public servants?
Yes.
Are they?
Yeah, well, applicants in that capacity.
They have commission.
Okay, then I've got another question.
I am on this committee. All right.
Well,
you're sworn, though.
But you're in here by statute. Now, suppose that the governor calls up the Multnomah Bar Association, and he says, gentlemen, I'd like to have you submit a list of five names because there's a vacancy in the district court, state district court, that is. So the president of the bar and the judicial selection committee swamp up a list of names. Are they
public servants.
It should be, yes.
Restore ethical opinion 140 the way it should.
Then my next question is, suppose the governor called up
supposing Clay Myers calls up Cap Evans because I got a legal problem, I want you to help him.
No, I'm aiming at a different thing, and I'm particularly concentrating on this judicial thing because it seems to me to present some of the problems that I think ought to be raised here and discussed. Suppose the governor gets the list from the bar, and so then he gets it narrowed down between A and B, and he calls up John Doe, well-known staunch Republican, I would say, substantial contributor in the past, and hope to be a substantial contributor in the future. And he says, what do you think of A and B? Which one do you think would make a better judge? Is John Doe a public servant here?
I wouldn't think so.
No.
I think that bribery, what we're really shooting at here, is a guy making a public judgment, expressing a judgment on the basis of some corrupt reason, and I think he probably wouldn't be under the statute, but he should be.
I would say that he would be as an advisor.
The thing is, it says an advisor at the request or direction of the state. I'm not sure I know what that means.
Can't you solve that by a person officially serving as an advisor, consultant, or assistant at the request of, and you got...
That's like substantial.
Well, not necessarily, because when you serve on a commission like this, you get sworn in. You take, Ed Westerdahl comes up and gives you the oath, or gives you your commission, or you get a letter from the governor, or from whoever it is, which is an official designation, so to speak. And doesn't that, and the bar committee, they get an official communication from it.
I don't know whether they do, as a matter of fact, or not.
Well, I'm sure John shouldn't be, like, say, if the governor calls up John Doe in a situation and say, well, let me think about it, I'll call you back tomorrow. And so in the meantime, he calls out and contacts either A and B or friends of A and B and says, okay, how much the governor is asking for opinion, how much is this judgeship worth to you? And so some one of them comes up and pays him $500. So shouldn't that be covered under the bribery statute?
No, it shouldn't, and I'll tell you why. Because if you look at the broad language of sub B here, you're not only talking about the governor, you're talking about any political subdivision or any governmental instrumentality within the state. So you got the Rockwood Water District, and you have the secretary of the water district who calls up somebody on the phone and asks them some advice or something. Is that person that minor functionary calls up a public servant? It just seems to me
if advice given is corrupt in nature and done for a corrupt purpose, then yes, I think it should be.
You've got a different situation there, though, than you have in Frank's case, where the governor or this clerk says bids are submitted by A company and B company. Why don't you think about this and let me know in a week what you think is the better bid or the better company or the most reliable. And then during that interval, someone approaches A company's president, approaches this fellow and says, well, now... here's $500 if you say that in your judgment that A company is the better group. And they should be covered in those situations, I would think.
Sure. I think the advisor is being corrupted.
That make any difference how far down, how limited the advice or how small the unit of government. Corrupt advice or corrupt action is the spending of people's money or the guidance of their lives or the change of their property values or any of these things equally bad. Make any difference whether it's a judge in Multnomah County or a justice of the peace in Ontario.
Well, I can't disagree with that. So the thing that continually plagues me about the revision of this
code is, you know, our primary function is to render the present arcade criminal code more concise and work. Language like this seems to me to get awfully unwieldy, and here we are arguing about its effect and how to scope. And I can just see Judge Perry's ghost coming in 2 or 3 years wanting 3 intermediate courts to determine all the appeals that are arising out of the questions that we've created.
You feel it's too broad? Is that the...
John, I don't think so.
Now, Mr. Chairman, now, the first draft on this defined public servant as meaning any public officer or employee of government, including legislators and judges, and any other person participating as an advisor, juror, consultant, or otherwise in performing governmental functions, and includes a person who has been elected or designated to become a public servant, although not yet occupying a position. Now, the subcommittee really zeroed in on that language. They felt it was too restrictive. And the minutes of the subcommittee meeting of June 10 indicate that that it should be broad enough to include things, and the language is here, such as water districts, quasi-municipal governments, school districts, sewer districts, and the feeling of the subcommittee was that draft should be amended to have broader language, such as reflected in this draft number 3, to get at the very thing that apparently Mr. or Senator Burns is objecting to now. And of course, it is a policy question, obviously, but it's difficult, it seems to me, if not impossible, to draw a definition of public servant that does not encompass
everything.
Some of these lesser officials or lesser employees. Of course, the evil you're getting at, or trying to get at, is not the position the person occupies, but whether or not there is a bribery situation. And if the individual is a secretary for the water board, and there's bribery involved, then why shouldn't they go, it seems to me?
Well, I think there are 4 sentences in the commentary that cover the things that Judge Burns and Senator Burns talk about. One, the gist of the offense is an attempt to wrongfully influence the course of public administration. This doesn't make any difference whether we're talking about the water board or the state of Oregon. Next one is the proposed definition of public servant does not contemplate the inclusion of persons advising public officials in a private capacity. This talks to your favorite Republican of Multnomah County, A versus B, normal course of events. Down farther than that thing, a businessman advising a member of the executive or legislative branch of government, the absence of official status would not be a public servant. This is the clerk calling up the friend saying, I can't understand insurance bids and compare them with the thing. Will you please look at them and tell me what's right? In the latter instance, and this would apply to the governor in the case of his friend, his campaign contributor, the public servant receiving the advice has a duty to exercise his own judgment on the merits of the advice. Now, if it goes one step past this and campaign contributor A has run over, Z has run over to candidate A and say, give me $500 and I'll tell the governor you're the man, then I think that it would apply. Should apply.
But you're reaching that not by a classification of the status of the individual, but rather by his activity in either giving honest or corrupt advice. And the reason that I brought this subject up was that it seemed to me it was important to have some legislative history. I really don't care. I don't have any strong feelings whether you have the Multnomah Bar Selection Committee in or out of it. I think it's not very, that particular one is not very important, but I do think that as far as possible, we ought to understand how wide we are spreading our net in this particular area.
one other thing, too. I think something should be the commentary, and I'm sure it's intended here, but the Oregon history of part-time public servants ranging all the way from legislature to water district, I assume we're talking about a person acting only in his capacity as a public servant, as opposed to the lawyer who is a public servant also giving advice or suggestions to someone who hires him.
Commentary, I think, covers that.
Does it cover
that? The lawyer is not.
Well, yeah, but that's something the lawyer, period. How about the lawyer who actually member of the legislature? He's a member of the court, the public servant, and.
It says the designation of the court does not create a contractual relationship empowering its act on behalf of the state.
All right, but how about the designation of the elected.
Yes, it does.
No, but he would be guilty of this type of conduct only if he's acting in an official capacity.
Well, he has to.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, see, it's
by the
here.
The definition of the crime.
Yeah, by bribe receiving and bribe giving, it's to exercise discretion in its official capacity.
Yeah,
bribe receiving,
a
decision or exercise discretion to come
to
be affected.
Okay, all right.
You're not going to run for it.
Any further discussion on this particular sub three? You heard the motion to approve sub three. Any further discussion?
Now I think you got a question. I think you should be talking here about this advisor, the solicitor. Money for how his advice should go that he be covered, but then I think the way this the commentary here read it, it does not cover.
Now we're getting ourselves into a trap, aren't we? The commentary is going to be as important as the as the statute for it for going.
Well, Mr.
And
Chairman, could what just for the record. And legislative history, would it be fair to say that a consensus of the commission agrees with language here where a businessman advising a member of the executive or legislative branch in the absence of official status would not be a public service? Do we agree with that?
In the absence of official status and the corrupt.
No, don't add that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any objection to leave to approving the commentary. The fact of business is that these shadowy areas are still going to have to be determined on the basis of what does the word official status mean. And I don't think we want up any definition that's going to be absolutely clear cut ahead of time that you can pick out and say in every instance this guy is in or this guy is out.
Is there anyone present who disagrees with that statement that a businessman advising a member of the executive or legislative branch of government in the absence of official status would not be a public servant?
I disagree.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
What's official talking about?
Commentary.
I don't think any of us are
talking about what.
Well, we got a letter though. Somebody pointing us to the committee. Certain questions.
Yeah, it's in the absence of official status. What creates the problem there? What is official status? It's a letter from the Oregon State Bar saying you're a member of the committee. Official status is.
I think of a. If the statute directs the Oregon State Bar to appoint a member,
but they do it. That's part of the bar.
I'll tell you what we can do. We can say if you're in the blue book, that means you're in. If you're not in the blue book, you're out.
We got official book.
Well, the way this is worded now, the guy who took the $500 in order to tell the governor who to appoint, the governor just called him on the phone, would not be included. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Right.
Otherwise, he can take that money and can give his influence to the governor.
Because this says here the governor is supposedly going to exercise his own judgment on the
governor has made a final decision. I don't like.
Of course, if the governor was in on the tape, well then there would be a bribery situation.
Sure.
We're not talking about that type.
Suppose he used the $500 for he and the governor to take a fishing trip and fund.
Well, you just, Chairman, I may just read out the word advisor then, because you're talking about public servant, that's easy, employee of the state, but we're trying to pick up the advisor, and I think there's a difference, obviously, some disagreement between the B, some B of three, and the commentary.
And you're always right, I don't think there's much chance for corruption in the government with the advisor situation.
More than that.
I think B and our commentary disagree.
I'm trying to arrive at a advisor.
I think that under 3B is somewhat in conflict with the statement as to a businessman who would be serving as an advisor.
In my mind, the kind of advisor you mentioned, the Secretary of the Department of Labor Commissioner, appointing someone and asking for a report and advice on the matter as an advisor, and that he does so for improper reasons or because of improper influence.
But I agree with Jack Burns. It would be virtually impossible to try and define every circumstance and every relationship that's going to arise.
But I don't want the governor to even call up somebody and ask his opinion, or a judge to call up somebody and ask his opinion on, or a district attorney, or clerk of the water board, anybody.
Look what you would do, Wally, if you change that. You would, in effect, be saying that a businessman advising a member of the executive or the legislative branch of government is a public servant.
In relationship to that advice?
Yes.
You really have
and
to.
That just isn't the case. No.
You'd have to isolate the legislators would have to be isolated from during their period of service from everybody who wasn't in the legislature, really.
Only the
corrupt. Vote for it, Paul.
Only the corrupt legislators would have to isolate themselves. But one of the criticisms of
the judiciary,
for example, is that they are too isolated.
Why do we see a lot of businessmen? That's just an example.
I think that's just an
example.
They're the kind that you've got to watch out for.
Thank you.
They didn't want to say clerks.
I just don't think we can get there from here.
Well, maybe, Mr. Chairman, the problem comes from some apparent disparity between that one sentence and 3B. Because 3B, read fairly and squarely, I think, includes people who don't have official status, whatever official status may mean. I think 3B, reasonably construed, would include a guy who doesn't have official status in the kind we're talking about.
Well, I think there's some critical language in there, and that is at the request or direction of the state, any political subdivision thereof, or any governmental instrumentality within the state. I think that would take out of this coverage of this section the individual who thinks he has or maybe holds himself out as having some particular influence with some state official such as the governor or anybody else, and he just gratuitously and officiously calls up or contacts the governor and offers his advice or offers his recommendations or tries to influence the governor. This individual is not serving at the request or direction of the state or any political subject.
No, I don't think they would be covered.
And he may be trying to peddle his influence to some third party over here, but I don't see how you can. I mean, the vice of bribery is, it seems to me, is you've got an individual and the state says that this is an evil thing because he's in an official position to peddle his influence, and he is in a position, either elected, because he's elected or appointed, to affect what goes on in the state. And whereas if you're trying to take in somebody out here in the public, it seems to me you're getting far beyond what bribery really is. I mean,
yeah, but Don, we have 1,492 governments in Oregon. if you're not in government as a private citizen, you just haven't been here long enough to establish your residence. If you've got more boards and commissions.
We've got 2,000 members of school boards in the state.
Well, sure, and if, but
another 2,000 members of school budget.
If you solicit a bribe to influence your action on the school board, the Board of Education, for example, it seems to me that's a completely different situation than if you go to a third party and say, well, I can call up the governor, I can contact the governor, and I'll be glad to do what I can, or I can influence this appointment if you'll make it worth my while, not as a member of the school board, but as Bob Chandler. Now, should you be guilty of bribery because you're Bob Chandler, or in that context, I'm saying, because you're removing it just one step, it seems to me. You're getting a third party into the situation here who is not opposed.
Well, that, Don, that takes care of the self-starter, but the point that concerns me is not the self-starter, it's the fellow that the public servant calls up and says, Fred, what do you think about such and such an appointment or bid or contract or job or whatever?
I think casual, of course, thing for the public, or the public servant, the initial public servant, governor, whoever, makes the initial contact, initiates the thing, and asks for advice. Then generally we've got to assume that he's going to consider the source of whatever advice he's asking.
Well, I think that's true,
but as I see it, and in the commentary, I don't think that's the guy we're shooting for as members of this commission. To act in an official capacity and furnish a report to make a recommendation and do some courses.
Let me ask then, what is official capacity? Does the Task Force 70, which probably will have as much influence on the course of business, the course direction of the state, and all the things we've done?
That would be official capacity.
That's official capacity. How about the Warren King study done by AOI? Don't say that's official capacity. It has nothing to do with the state. Done by a private agency for a separate organization,
right,
to advise, and the legislature acted upon.
Didn't have any, no. They
well, but it was requested by the governor.
So that's not
requested by the Board of Education.
The most significantly, singularly significant study of education in the state of Oregon, we just determined now has no official capacity.
Well, it was a private contractual arrangement. It's just like the, like when the capital,
Of course, the public servant has a private contractual relationship with the state. I mean, that the contract doesn't remove it. Being an independent contractor doesn't remove you from an advisor's capacity. Does that absolve you from taking a bribe and you get paid for it?
No.
They're paid advisors. And this,
well, he's getting at his influence peddling. He's probably the most insidious form of bribery, the most difficult to find.
That's come up
to the federal government. If we take it out, yeah. Well, we take it out of here completely. Are we sanctioning it? Are we saying it's not? Are we saying it's all right?
I think that it's just unfortunate that, with respect to this businessman here, that its intent was merely to have an example. And
let's call it a lawyer.
If we were simply to take that, if we were to remove that sentence, I think we could probably live with sub B. Certainly, the Warren King, later contacted the fiscal committee. Someone pays them to make a particular recommendation. It certainly should be covered, whether it's a public servant or not.
Covered anywhere now at all. Unless the other one doesn't see that. By the spirit of person I do, nor by the individual private citizen who was contacted by the government to advise. I think it's covered.
Now, this is not likely to be, I don't think, that the individual public citizen who was contacted by the government for advice is not likely to be the subject or giver, recipient of bribery in the sense that we know it. In the first place, he's unlikely to know in advance that the governor's going to call. He's unlikely to have time to go out and arrange to be bribed. You know, the governor's on the phone, and you answer him, you don't
see what I can hustle up. Which you might don't. Well, we let you on hold.
I only have 2 days to see what I can hustle up, you know. This is, what? The guy who was serving on the governor's advisory committee on the conduct of the ombudsman or whatever he is, knows in advance that his opinion is going to be sought. The hope for it is, that's what he said. Then he goes out prior to giving his advice or to make his recommendation and hustles up something. And I see that he's in a different position.
Tell us in kind of a great situation that what he does, he says, I'll give you a call back.
I think we're fighting windmills. Really.
Well, what we've done this morning, and nothing else in the last hour and a half, is prove the commentary is equally important to the stage.
I don't think we are fighting windmills. I can think of, in my own personal case, I have an attorney who served as my chairman of my campaign committee. And I routinely call him on all kinds of matters. If when the county commission was going to appoint a state senator, I called and discussed it with him. He could have almost predicted ahead of time that that was going to happen. Would have known that I'd probably call him. And could be calling up these various state senators. Now, I think he should be in and covered for bribery.
Well, a person serving as an advisor, consultant, or assistant. Now, it has to be at the request or direction of the state, which means any official of that state, or political subdivision thereof, or of any governmental instrumentality within the state. Now, what this leaves out is the person who, without being requested to offer his advice, but does, or supposedly does, have some influence with someone who is able to make a decision, accepting money from some third party for him without being requested to do so, to suggest to the state official that he do this, that, or the other thing. So that's why I say that this covers...
Well, that's obvious.
Yeah, well, that's also a salesman for IBM,
right,
or Royal Typewriters, or...
But this doesn't cover those, that situation. This is only when the request is initiated from the state or the... So I think this is all right. Are you ready to vote on sub 3, or do you want to discuss it some more?
I thought we voted on it.
Yeah,
we were talking about the
commentary. No, we didn't actually vote.
No, because Knight stopped us. That's why we did it.
Do you have
a motion just to adopt it?
Yes.
Well, what happens to the commentary? Are we going to...
Well, I thought perhaps we should take them one at a time.
Is there a motion?
Yeah, there is a motion.
There is a motion to approve
question
3. Call roll.
Go ahead.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
No. Instead of calling roll, just raise your right hand. Then we have to cover it anyway. Carry. Now, with respect to the commentary, Frank?
In the range of vote on the whole session.
Well, yeah, we will be.
I think we should... I do that we strike what is the sentence of businessman advising the member of the executive legislative branch.
And have the minutes show that the reason for striking it is it may create some confusion in the interpretation.
Next to the last two.
No, next to the last.
The last two
sentences.